This program is for entertainment and educational purposes and without warranty as to completeness and accuracy of the commentary or opinions. The opinions expressed are solely those of the host and not those of the sponsors or affiliate attorneys or this radio station. No attorney-client relationship is established by any response or commentary on a legal subject. Alabama law requires the following disclaimer. No representation is made that the quality of legal services to be performed is greater than the legal service of other lawyers. Welcome to Law Chat 24/7, a weekly show that reviews and discusses legal issues that impact you and our community. Sponsored by Boatler Richardson Wolf Injury Lawyers, proudly serving the citizens of the Alabama, Mississippi, Florida Gulf Coast since 1987. Now, your hosts of Law Chat 24/7, attorney Mark Wolf and his co-host Marion Boatler.
Hello and welcome to Law Chat 24/7. I'm Mark Wolf, and my co-host is Marion Boatler. Marion, yeah. How was your week?
Marion Boatler here.
How was your week?
It was good. Actually, I am preparing for my son's 11th birthday, so I have been trying to plan that a remote birthday or a social distancing birthday, so that's been a lot of fun.
Okay, so what are y'all going to do? What's the big event?
Oh, well, don't tell them that we're going on a scavenger hunt just around different places in the car, and he's going to have to guess the next place. So it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it, an activity for all of us.
Lots of challenges during these times. So why don't you remind our listeners how they can get their questions submitted and answered and maybe even become a topic for a subject of a conversation?
Sure. Well, yes, you can go to our website, lawchat247.com, and submit your questions. Or you can now also submit your questions as a message through the Law Chat 24/7 Facebook page. In fact, we have several questions tonight come through Messenger on the Facebook page.
Well, that's great. Speaking of the Law Chat Facebook page, I had posted just kind of more curious about people's favorite legal movies, and I shared that to my personal page and got a tremendous response from a lot of different people on different favorite legal movies. And before we get to our first question, I was just curious, do you have a favorite legal movie or two?
I know, actually, I was thinking about that, and I have always loved My Cousin Vinny. And it's one of those movies that you can kind of watch over and over and over again, and you just love it. So, My Cousin Vinny. I love Marissa Tomei. I think she was fabulous, and Ralph Macchio. So, that's one of my faves.
Yeah, that was a great one. I love it when he puts Miss DeVito on the stand as an expert witness.
That was the best. It's the best. In fact, she won an Academy Award for that. So,
I did not realize that.
She did. I just love it. I think it's so funny, and I love the expert witness, yes. And Jen, yeah. She just goes at it.
Any others at top of your list?
I mean, you know, you have your Legally Blonde, which is always a fun little show. And then A Few Good Men, who, you know, was Tom Cruise in that one, of course. Those. And what was the one by Nicholas Sparks? Or which one was the big one when it was down in the South? And they were... who was in that? I can't remember. My memory's escaping me. What about you, Mark?
Oh, my Cousin Vinny's at the top of the list. Of course, I think almost all lawyers are fans of either the book or the movie To Kill a Mockingbird.
Of course, yes.
But it's interesting that the two of the top 25 movies, legal movies, To Kill a Mockingbird and My Cousin Vinny, are both actually set in small Alabama courtrooms. So
That's right. They are.
The American Bar Association posted a list of their 25 greatest legal movies in 2018. And you want to guess what was top of the list?
Oh, I would, like you said, maybe To Kill a Mockingbird. Was that it?
It was. Uh-huh. And then second was an older movie called 12 Angry Men. Now you have to go back a ways. That was a black and white movie with Henry Fonda. It was a jury deliberating a murder case, and it focused on all the personality conflicts within the jury room and how that all went down. So that was number two. Number three is our fave, My Cousin Vinny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Number four, they said, was Anatomy of a Murder, a 1959 movie, which I've never seen. That apparently starred Jimmy Stewart and Lee
mm-hmm.
Remick.
Mm-hmm.
Number five, this is an old one. I have seen this one, Inherit the Wind, with Spencer Tracy. It was the Scopes Monkey Trials in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
Number six, they said, is Witness for the Prosecution. That was a relatively recent movie that's an older movie directed by Billy Wilder with Tyrone Power.
Huh.
So that's number seven is, then this was one of the movies I've never even heard of, and now I'm anxious to go watch it. It was released in 1980, Breaker Morant. They say it's three Australian lieutenants are court-martialed for executing prisoners as a way of deflecting attention from war crimes committed by their superior officers. I've never heard of that, but it sounds like it could be interesting. Number eight's a good one. It stars Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington. Do you remember what that one was?
Oh, goodness. Oh, I don't. Philadelphia? No.
Exactly. Yes,
yay!
That was it. That was a good movie. That was a fun movie to watch.
Yes.
Number nine they have is Aaron Brockovich.
That was a good one. I forgot about that one.
Yeah. And number 10, an old one, but a good one, one of my favorite actors, The Verdict with Paul Newman. Have you ever seen that one?
You know what? I don't think I have.
Oh, that's a good one.
We have plenty of time to watch them now.
Yes, yes, we do. All right. Well, that's kind of a fun little jaunt down the movie lane. Let's jump into a question. Do we have a question? Oh, the first question comes from our Facebook page, doesn't it?
It does, Mark. It says, this was from our Facebook page, Law Chat 24/7. It comes from there. This is from Joan, who posted, the IRS will not release my refund. Is that affecting my stimulus payment?
Okay, well, it should not be. The IRS does have the ability to withhold refunds if you owe federal money for any type of federal repayments or federal debts or anything like that, as well as child support. But on the stimulus package, they passed a provision that said that the IRS would not withhold any of the stimulus money for anything other than child support. That's the only one reason they can withhold the money. So even if her IRS refund is being held for some sort of a repayment on a federal benefit or overpayment on a federal benefit, that should not affect her stimulus payment.
Good.
Mm-hmm. to recover her money. And they were sending the stimulus payments to the, if you direct deposited your IRS refund checks, that's where your stimulus check's going to go. I know there's been some complaints about them being slow coming out, and I think that the IRS has actually had some glitches in their programs, but have now said they've addressed those. So hopefully everybody's getting those stimulus checks. And even if she owed federal money for something other than child support, it should not affect the stimulus repayment check. So, all right, do we have time to squeeze another question in before our first break?
This is from Chandra, wants to know if in Alabama a seatbelt violation is a moving violation.
Okay, well, I'll give her a quick answer since we're coming up on our first break. No. In Alabama, not a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt is considered an equipment violation, not a moving violation. Even though you may have been in your car when it was moving, it's not considered a moving violation, which are generally your speeding, running a stop sign, failure to yield. Those type tickets are moving violations. Tickets like a brake light out or improper tag, those are generally considered equipment violations. So that's not a moving violation to go against your record. So, all right, we're coming up on our first break. That moved pretty quick. Mary, tell folks how they can get their questions submitted.
Absolutely. You can submit your questions through our website, lawchat247.com, or through the Facebook page, Law Chat 24/7, and Messenger on Facebook.
We'll be right back right after this short break. Thank y'all for listening tonight.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
All right, welcome back to our second segment. That was a fun first segment, reviewing some of the top legal movies. I'm sure everybody has their favorite. You can join us on our Law Chat Facebook page and share your opinion on your favorite legal movie. You can also send us a message with a question through our Facebook page, or just send us a question through lawchat247.com. You will get a response in 24 hours. It's free and 100% confidential. So that was a fun segment, Marion.
It was. And I'm impressed that our favorite movie of, well, my favorite movie, My Cousin Vinny, legal movie that is, was number two.
Yes, it's up there among the, it's up there among all the favorites. So again, kind of ironic that two of the top legal movies are both set in small Alabama courtrooms. So, and right, very different, right, dramatically from To Kill a Mockingbird to My Cousin Vinny. So
it does.
All right. Well, let's jump back into our next, let's get our next question.
Great. This question is from Aaron B. It says, my father passed away in January of 2019 due to cirrhosis of the liver, per the autopsy report. I filed a claim with his life insurance company, and this week they sent me a check for about $600 for past premiums he had paid, with the note that the policy had been rescinded. He was diagnosed with cirrhosis a year ago, and he had this policy 1 year and 9 months. So he didn't make it to the 2 year mark, so they contested it. The claims adjuster said underwriting denied the claim because he had heart problems in his medical records that he did not disclose. But he didn't die of heart problems. This policy is worth $50,000. Should I try to contest or appeal this decision myself, or is it worth it to get an attorney on this matter? I'm also afraid if I cash this check, I'll give up my rights to appeal or contest the denial for benefits.
Okay, well, there is a lot going on in that question. To start with, I would suggest not cashing the refund check, because sometimes that might be considered or construed as an acceptance of the denial, and it may make reopening the appeal harder. Mm-hmm. At this point, I would just hold that check until you make a decision, Aaron, on what you're going to do. So let's start with the basics here. When you apply for life insurance, you make certain, you provide them certain information about your health history, and based upon that, they decide whether or not to undertake the risk of writing you a policy. Almost all smaller policies have a 2 year, what we call look back period, or right of contestability. And what that means is the insurance company, if a person dies during that 2 year period, can then go start looking back and determining whether or not everything on the application was truthful or fully disclosed. It doesn't mean you doesn't even mean that you have to have tried to lie or mislead them. Even if you just made a mistake, that could still be considered a material misrepresentation. And in this case, this is something we see a lot of. People are like, well, he died of cirrhosis of the liver. That was nothing to do with the heart problems. And how can they deny the claim? Well, the problem is the law says that if it's a representation that is material to the risk undertaken by the insurance company, whether or not that's what was the cause of death, the insurance company has a right to come back in and rescind the policy or cancel the policy and then refund the premiums. So question becomes, was the heart problems that were not disclosed, were those material misrepresentations to the risk undertaken by the insurance company? This is a very, very common area of dispute on life insurance policies, but also a very, very complex area of law. What is material is based upon the underwriting guidelines of that company. underwriting guidelines vary from company to company. There are certain things that you can look at and say are pretty common as non-rights or underwriting red flags for most insurance companies. But again, they vary from company to company. So the question becomes, was it a material misrepresentation to the company? And the secondary issue, is it something that the company may have known about? Sometimes companies undertake some brief underwriting before they issue a policy. If they had underwritten this policy and done a quick review and saw that there were some hard issues and they knew that and still issued the policy, it's no longer a material misrepresentation. So it gets really complex. Then you get into whether this is a federally controlled policy or a state policy controlled by state law. Federal law is very, very tight on the appeal. You've got a certain period of time to do it. You've got certain restrictions. And it becomes, if you don't do the appeal right, it limits you on what you can do to sue for the full amount of the benefits. So the first thing I would tell this gentleman, Aaron, don't cash the check. Go talk to an attorney that understands life insurance claims and the ins and outs of life insurance claims. Have that attorney review it and see if there is a potential to argue that it was not a material misrepresentation. I've done a lot of these cases over the years. I have underwriting guidelines from a lot of different insurance companies. And a lot of times what I will do is I'll just review some of those underwriting guidelines and look and see, is this something that is a common decline for most insurance? COPD being one of them, almost always that's a decline. So if that's an issue, I can look at the guidelines and say, look, they probably got a legitimate point here. So again, consult with it. Don't cash the check. Go talk to an attorney. And I would tell them not to give up on it's a $50,000 policy. I would tell them not to give up on it without at least talking to a lawyer that knows what's going on. So, all right. That's a lot of information.
That's a question with a lot of different points.
So,
right. Well, good, good. And a lot of good information. So that's good. We're ready for our next question. It is JW in Pascagoula asks, does Mississippi allow for grandparent visitation?
Okay, and this came in through our lawchat247.com site, and I did already address this issue earlier directly to the inquirer, but yes, Mississippi does allow for grandparent visitation in certain situations. It's not an automatic, and that's similar in most states. This is an area, though, that people have to understand varies from state to state to state. Florida's grandparent visitation laws may be different than Alabama's grandparent visitation laws, which may be different than Mississippi's grandparent visitation laws. So you really need to talk with a lawyer specifically in that jurisdiction. And I did put JW in touch with somebody over there to consult with. But generally, yes, Mississippi does allow for grandparent visitation if the grandparent and the child have an active relationship based upon a history of either providing financial support and or frequent visitations for at least 1 year. In other words, there has to be some grandparent-child relationship in order for the grandparent to make a claim for visitation rights. The second one, and this is the one that really is very, very, very variable from state to state, but the second one in Mississippi is the child parent has to have unreasonably denied grandparent visitation. Now, what we get into here is the courts do give a high deference to the parents' rights as to who they want their child to associate with. Mm-hmm. In other words, if someone feels like a grandparent would be a bad influence because of something they believe or something they do, then that parent's decision is going to be given high deference by the court. So the restriction on visitation has to be unreasonable. And then finally, the court will look at the underlying number one guide is what is in the child's best interest, considering the child's health, safety, and welfare. So those are the three things in Mississippi that the courts look at. in determining whether or not there's grandparent visitation, and the action has to be brought in the court or of the jurisdiction where the children live. And again, the biggest thing in all states is that the courts are going to give high deference to the parents on their views. In other words, somebody may say, well, the child's grandparents are atheists, and I don't want my child in that environment because I'm a Christian. Restricting the child's to that environment is not necessarily considered unreasonable. That's a parental choice. So these are tough cases. Again, not my area of law, but very, very difficult cases. And a lot of emotions involved in these cases. So they get tough.
Well, thank you, Mark. The next question is from Jonathan. It says, I was fired at work. I was a cashier and a customer used a fake coupon. I didn't know it was fake. The security man said I was her accomplice and fired me. They did not give me any chance to explain or give me a hearing like it says in the handbook. I feel I was wrongfully terminated and not given due process. What are my rights and what should I do?
All right. Wrongful termination is, and I believe Jonathan's question came from Alabama, and we'll talk after the break about Alabama law and wrongful termination. This is a very, very common area where we get lots and lots of questions. People always, if they get terminated, they don't feel like they were given a fair shake, and they feel like they want to pursue a wrongful termination claim. But again, in Alabama, that's very limited in when you can pursue the wrongful termination, because we just don't really recognize that as a claim. What we'll do when we get back, though, is I'll give you some pointers for Jonathan on what he should do in this situation to try to protect himself and help his situation so without having to get a lawyer involved. So we'll come back to the same question after our break. Marion, tell me.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
All right, welcome back to Law Chat. During our break, our technician, Charles, told us we were picking up some clicking or some unusual noises in the background. I'm not sure where that's coming from. We apologize. We are doing our show remotely. I'm in Daphne and Marion's over in Mobile, and we have our production man at the studio. So it is a little crazy, and we apologize if there's any type of noise or anything in the background causing some issues or problems. When we went to break, we were talking, Marion, about the claim of Jonathan. He had been fired. Yes. What did they say he had done?
That he, they thought that he was in basically cahoots with, or an accomplice with, someone that used a fake coupon.
Okay. And he wanted to know if he could sue for wrongful termination. And Alabama law does not recognize wrongful termination claims, only in the context of workers' comp. You can't be fired for making a workers' compensation claim. That you have a wrongful termination claim if you were fired because of workers' comp. Our state laws don't recognize any other type of wrongful termination claims. You do have rights under the federal law, your civil rights. You can't be fired because of race, religion, national origin, etc. But what we tell people in this situation, a couple things to do here. First, I always suggest that the terminated worker send an email, a fax, or a letter back to the employer outlining why they felt the termination was wrongful and unfair. You can say, I feel like it was wrongfully terminated, even though there may not be a cause of action. But you want to put it in writing your position, and there's a couple reasons for that. But you also want to make sure you keep a copy. In the letter, after you outline why you feel like you were wrongfully terminated, I always recommend or suggest that you ask for the possibility of returning to work. I would like to return to work if possible, and I would ask that you give this determination reconsideration. You want to show that you're a good employee who wants to come back and do your job. Finally, in the letter, you should mention that you would like a copy of the letter or email or fax, whatever you send in, put in your personnel file. The reason for that is simply because I think an employer would be less likely to give you a bad recommendation if they knew you had contested the termination in your and it was part of your personnel file. Now, the reason you want to do all of that is because if they don't take you back and they don't give you any type of severance or whatever, you may have to try to get unemployment benefits. You're not entitled to unemployment benefits if you're terminated for cause. In Jonathan's situation, if he goes down and applies for unemployment benefits, they will send his employer a notice saying he's applying for unemployment benefits, and the employer can check a little box that says he was terminated for cause. If that happens, then Jonathan has sent a notice that says your employer says you were terminated for cause. You can appeal this. And that's where the letter becomes very critical, because then he can submit the letter to the unemployment compensation people saying, look, here's the letter I sent. I feel like I was wrongfully terminated, and I feel like I should be entitled to unemployment benefits. I was not terminated for cause. The unemployment compensation division generally tends to be pro-employee. So if you've got something to present for your side of the case in opposition to the terminated for cause, there's a very good chance you will still get your unemployment benefits. So very critical, send a letter outlining why you feel like you were wrongfully terminated. Keep a copy of that. Ask for the right to return to work and ask that the letter be put in your personnel file. And then if you apply for unemployment benefits, you hopefully have something in your back pocket to help if they contest your right to unemployment benefits because they claim you're fired for cause. So good luck to Jonathan. And I'd already talked to him earlier and given him all that information, but it was a good question. So we will follow back up and see where it goes. So, all right. Yeah. How about our next question?
Very good advice. The next question is from Michael W. He asked, my wife and I earn about the same amount of money. We're talking about getting a divorce, and she says the lawyer she talked to said I'll have to pay all the child support for our two children. That doesn't seem right. Is that lawyer right? How is child support calculated?
Okay. Well, let's start with a lot of times somebody will talk to a lawyer and the lawyer may give them some information or some advice or just some general guidance. And unfortunately, sometimes people hear what they want to hear and not really what the lawyer said. Mm-hmm. In this situation, I cannot imagine any lawyer that does domestic work that if he was or she was told that two people earn the same amount of money, that the other spouse would have to pay all of the child support. Now, in this situation, Michael, I don't know if your wife actually talked to a lawyer or if she's just maybe bluffing a little bit. I don't know. But the way child support works is we have in Alabama some basic child support guidelines that correlate with the amount of income the household brings home. In other words, if the household brings home $10,000 a month in overall income, then the child support guidelines show how much money each month should be allocated out of that $10,000 for child support. Then the court looks to what percentage of the income is brought in by each parent. In this case, and we'll just use $10,000, if both of them are bringing in $5,000 a month and the child support amount is set at, and I'm just picking numbers because I don't know the child support guidelines off the top of my head, but if the child support guidelines are set at $3,000, then the non-custodial parent would be responsible for 50% in that situation since they both earn 50% of the income, or approximately $1,500. Now, the other thing to keep in mind, anytime lawyers say guidelines, that's exactly what they are, guidelines. These are not etched in stone, and the court can look at and consider other factors when assessing a child support obligation for the non-custodial parent. But the non-custodial parent will have to pay their pro rata portion of that child support amount that's set forth in the guidelines based upon their percentage of income. So it's not that complicated to calculate. And generally, most lawyers that do domestic relations work can give you an overview or an estimate of what the child support is likely to be entered by the judge in a certain situation. I would tell Michael that if it looks like they are headed for a divorce, and since his wife has indicated she has talked to a lawyer already, mm-hmm. that he may want to go ahead and talk to a lawyer himself. Also, I know a lot of times people don't want to pay lawyer fees for consultations, but it can be critical in these type situations to get the correct amount of benefits and know what's going to happen and have someone that's working to protect your interests. So, mm-hmm. all right. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on that one, Marion?
No, I know, but that's very, I know it can get tricky with that type of law and just situation. So I wish them the best.
And keep the children hopefully they can reconcile, work through it. So,
well, are you ready for our next question?
Sure. Let's go jump into it.
Okay. This is Missy in Grand Bay wants to know the difference between Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and how do you choose which one?
Okay. This is a pretty good question, something that's pretty common with people who are considering bankruptcy and who have financial difficulties or in a financially strained situation. Let's start with the basics between the difference between Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, and then we'll talk about choosing which one. Chapter 7 is a total liquidation, except for the exemptions you're allowed by court and any debts you want to reaffirm in the process. In other words, if you don't have a lot of equity or a lot of assets and you want to do a total liquidation, you might want to keep your car. So you could reaffirm that debt as something you want to keep and continue to pay and liquidate all the other debts that you have. A Chapter 7 bankruptcy takes about 3 to 4 months. Now, Chapter 13 is a restructure and a reorganization. In other words, you don't get to totally liquidate all of your debts and your obligations. The court will look at those total debts and total obligations and try to set you up on a repayment plan that can be either a 3-year or a 5-year plan. You may be paying back only a portion of the debts, or you may be paying back all of the debts. That's something for the court to determine based upon your income, your assets, everything that you may have related to the bankruptcy, and a trustee will be assigned to oversee this process and make sure that your payment amounts are a fair amount. It is really up to the court to make that determination. Here, the difference is you don't necessarily get to choose which one, because the court has the guidelines and the parameters on who can qualify for a Chapter 7 and who has to go into a Chapter 13 restructure and reorganization. If you have a lot of equity in your house and you have a lot of other assets, you're most likely not going to qualify for a Chapter 7 total liquidation, mm-hmm. and you'll have to go through restructure and reorganization. Now, you may only pay back 50 cents on the dollar for all of your debts over that period of time, or you may pay 100%. Again, that's up to the trustee and the bankruptcy court on what they will allow you to do. So if you're considering a bankruptcy, highly, highly recommend consulting with an experienced bankruptcy attorney. They can give you a lot more ins and outs on who may qualify or what the parameters are for qualifying for total liquidation, Chapter 7, versus a Chapter 13 restructure and organization. But again, you don't necessarily, it's not a matter of you get to choose, because there are parameters and guidelines set out by the court as to who can qualify for what type of liquidation or debt. So, all right. Well, it looks like we're coming up on our next break. Marion, before we go to break, you want to tell folks how they can get their questions answered?
Absolutely. You can submit your legal questions through lawchat247.com and get a response from a lawyer in 24 hours. It's free and 100% confident. You can also submit through the Facebook page, lawchat247.com, or excuse me, lawchat247 in the Messenger section.
Very good. We'll be right back after this next break.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
All right, welcome back to our final segment. The last segment section we'll do tonight is our Can I Sue section. But before we get to that, Marion, do we have another question we can jump into?
We do. This question is from Bill. He asks, I'm not happy with the lawyer handling my car accident injury case. It's been going on for months, and he will not return my call. I want to fire him. Is that possible?
Okay. Again, a very common question that we see and get a lot of in the field of injury work. First, the simple and easy answer is yes. You can fire him if you're not happy with his services. However, before doing that, you might want to, there's a couple things to think about and look at. First, Bill did not indicate what the status of his medical care was, but on a personal injury claim, you have to realize that you cannot make your finalize your claim until you're finished with your medical care and treatment. So if Bill is still under care and treatment for his injury, then his claim really is not ready for presentation to the insurance company yet. Because again, remember, in Alabama, when you accept a settlement on an injury case, it's over. You don't get to go back and say, hey, I need more money for this, or they now say I need physical therapy or I need surgery. So a lot of times personal injury cases kind of drag on because the victim is still getting care and treatment, and the lawyer is, there's not really a lot for the lawyer to do until the person is finished getting their care and treatment. So I'm not sure about that, but I will say this, not returning a call and not keeping in contact with clients is the number one complaint that the Bar Association receives every year about from clients about lawyers. In our office, we try to make sure we stay in contact with our clients. One of the things we do that not every law firm does is we do send our clients copies of all letters and material that we send out, so they'll see what's happening on their case. One of the biggest frustrating parts for clients is once they are released, we have to get all their medical records together. Well, sometimes we have to send out three or four requests for those medical records. So when we send it out, we'll put second request or third request, and the client will get a copy of that, so they'll see we're still trying to get those records and documents together. But again, the next thing, if he wants, before firing or changing gears, I would suggest he send the letter, send the lawyer an email or a text or just some communication saying, I would like to sit down and talk to you about my case. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you can clean things up before having to make that decision to jump to another lawyer. So, all right. Well, let's just jump right into our Can I Sue section. Because that's going to be kind of a lengthy, and that's from, who's that? Who's the number, the Can I Sue question from tonight?
It is from Frances from Silver Hill, and she wants to know about suing China for the coronavirus. She asks, I've seen where the state of Missouri has sued China for causing the coronavirus. Why hasn't Alabama done the same thing?
All right. Well, and this is an interesting area, and the state of Mississippi is actually about to file suit also against China. The problem is that we have treaties and we have guidelines that most likely are going to prohibit these type of lawsuits from going forward. The U.S. has enacted the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. That's kind of a uniform act by most countries that just basically say, our people are not going to sue your country. And it's a treaty that all the countries have agreed to. So the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act is probably going to prohibit jurisdiction over this action. Again, it may not, because there's actually two bills in Congress that are trying to remove or strip China of their sovereign immunity under that act so that these type of lawsuits can go forward. I don't know what's going to happen with that. As a lawyer, we often look at not just the case in front of us, but what does that mean down the road?
Right.
And do we really want not just our state suing different governments, but do we want different countries suing our government? And do we want a province in China to be able to file a counterclaim against the state of Mississippi for frivolous lawsuit? Most of these things can be handled through the International Court of Justice, commonly called the World Court. The International Court of Justice civilly enforces treaties and violations. If there's something that rises to the level of a criminal act, there's the International Criminal Court. And in fact, there's a lawyer out of Texas who has actually filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court against China for what he considers their action in covering up the consequences of the coronavirus. He has filed a complaint with the ICC. His name is Larry Klayman, and he's the founder of Freedom Watch. And he filed a complaint with the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which is in The Hague, Netherlands. He also has filed a class action lawsuit in Texas for individuals in Texas who have been damaged by the coronavirus. Where this will go, it's awfully hard to say. These type cases are very complex. Class action, whether or not you can bring a class action against another sovereignty, I don't know. This is kind of an interesting area of law, one that involves a lot of international treaty laws. And again, that is what the International Court of Justice is set up for, is to handle these type claims between sovereignties. And again, in our country, the United States is the sovereign. So any action in the International Court of Justice would need to be brought through our United States Department of Justice and not by a attorney general from one of those states. But it's an interesting area of a lot. What do you think?
Well, I don't know what to think about that, just because it's so hard to imagine. But is Missouri the only state that has filed suit against China so far?
So far, Missouri is the only one. Mississippi is apparently looking at it, and their attorney general, according to a Sinclair Media Group report, has drafted one but has not filed one yet. I don't know. I don't think they have much traction. I will say this too on these type lawsuits. Sometimes these type lawsuits are more rhetorical and done for rhetoric purposes. Uh-huh. And that's all fine and good. But if the taxpayers of Missouri and Mississippi end up having to foot the bill for a politician's grandstanding, I'm not sure. I don't know if that's a smart move or not. And I'm not saying these cases don't have merit, and I'm not saying they shouldn't maybe have their day in court. But
right.
I think you have to balance out a lot of those issues when considering these type cases and these type claims. So it's
right.
Interesting. We do have up on our website, our Facebook page, you can put your comments on this topic if you want to share with us. So
absolutely. Yes. And if you ever want to submit a question, lawchat247.com or Facebook.
Learn more at brwlawyers.com.
There we go.
If you need a response to a legal question, go to lawchat247.com. That's lawchat247.com and submit your question. And be sure to join us next Tuesday evening at 7 for another edition of Law Chat 24/7, when we will continue to review and discuss legal issues that impact you and our community.